Every year there's a seminar course at Caltech where the incoming graduate students in physics, who are some really sharp kids, get to hear each faculty member talk about their research. And when I finish this talk, I always ask them, because I'm quite curious about this, how many of you had a high school teacher that blew your mind? And more than 50% of them raised their hands. And then I say, okay, for the remaining 50%, what happened to you? And 25% of them had the equivalent such teacher in college. That's very scary. And the reason it's scary is that most people are not so lucky. Sad. So I guess, you know, I tip my hat to you. It's really important. I mean, I have to tell you, I bailed out of high school after 11th grade. I've never taken a physics class in high school or since. Except in grad school. I never took a chemistry class. I hated math. I thought school was totally a glue factory. So it's people like you that make a difference. And unfortunately, I didn't meet such a person. So anyway, what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and tell you about what Darwin referred to as the sixth sense. He said in his autobiography, "In after years, I've deeply regretted that I did not proceed far enough to at least to understand something of the great leading principles of mathematics. For men or women thus endowed seem to have an extra sense." So what I want to do is try to explore what he might have meant by that. So the talk is going to go something as follows. I'm going to start out really with basically some philosophical blah blah, which will probably take me 10 or 15 minutes. And in particular, I'm going to try and make an analogy between the astronomy at the time of Tycho Brahe and the biology, say, of 100 years ago, and that we're living in exactly the same kind of amazing 150-year period right now that astronomy lived through then. I'm going to try and make a lot about what I think teachers are supposed to do is make their students prejudiced. Okay, that's exactly what I'm going to try to do, is talk about developing prejudice. And then I'm going to give you a few examples of order of magnitude biology from genome science. Then I'm going to basically tell you, like Boris did, two case studies. One of them is managing genomes. So how is it that the fact that DNA is a physical molecule interplays with the fact that it's the informational carrier that really distinguishes living matter from ordinary matter? And then I'm going to give you a second case study that has to do with how cells decide where to go. All of these examples are linked by, as I would say here, a compelling biological theme, which is information management, with a beautiful physical theme, which is random walks. So it really comes down to the elegance and the potency of being able to flip coins. And if I have time, I'll even amuse you with what my co-author Yana and I did yesterday morning. My wife looked at me like we were morons, because I was sitting on my couch, on my floor in my bedroom, and flipping coins. I did 100 of them yesterday. Anyway, so the connection to astronomy. There's a comment that was supposedly made by Galileo. I actually don't think he did say it, but he could have and should have, which is measure what is measurable and make measurable what is not so. And my point in bringing this up is that science has really always been transformed by new ways, first of observing the world, and then after that, more importantly, measuring the world. Tycho Brahe, at the age of something like 18, was very disappointed with the astronomical tables. He was more or less pissed off. He could not figure out where Mars was going to be, and as you know, it has a complicated motion across the heavens. And he decided that he needed to develop better instruments in order to measure the position of Mars so that we could once and for all settle the question of, you know, what makes this thing tick. And as I said before, I think that we're living through exactly the same kind of moment in biology that they were living in at this era in astronomy. So probably many of you know Tycho Brahe, very colorful character, didn't have a nose, got in sword fights, lived on an island in Denmark, but he built amazing instruments. And if, just like the story of the clock and longitude, if you go look on Wiki, you can find that Tycho Brahe, over the course of his career, he built many, many instruments. Very sophisticated. And so, you know, I have the spreadsheet of his data on my laptop, and basically what he did is made careful measurements of the positions of Mars. That is basically a prelude to the ability of someone like Kepler to come along to elucidate the laws of planetary motion, and, you know, and as we say, the rest is history. I don't think you'll be able to read this, but if you want, I can. If you send me a mail, I'll tell you what this is. It's from Nature, from something like 1902. And what this is it's a story about the labs in Germany, the Heidelberg Physical Laboratory. And what I love about this, it's about Bunsen and Kirchhoff. So most of us know Bunsen as burner, but I mean, that's ridiculous. This guy's a serious scientist. And Kirchhoff and Bunsen, they were looking out on the city of Mannheim during a fire. And they noticed that they could detect barium and strontium. And Bunsen said to Kirchhoff, "I just had the most crazy idea. If we can figure out what's in the fire, we can figure out what's in a star." And Kirchhoff said, "Well, you know, if you're crazy, I'm crazy too. Let's do it." And so, you know, that's a straight line to the telescopes that I see above Pasadena. You know, I look at them, I feel romantically. I ask for a left-hand window seat on airplanes so that when I take off from LAX and we turn over the ocean, I can spot those telescopes. And on the right, I ask for a right-hand window seat when I'm coming home. I like looking at that and thinking of Hubble and others trying to figure out, you know, what's going on with the redshifts of the galaxies. Anyway, so new technologies transform the way we think about the world. So clearly in biology, such things have been happening. And I think the best evidence of this is at the time that all of our parents were born, most people thought the genetic information was carried by proteins, not by DNA. That wasn't very long ago, okay? And so if somebody said that in one of your classes, you'd probably flunk them, okay? But you know, serious people said it 60 or 70 years ago. The ability to read and write DNA has completely changed the way we view the world, and I wanted to tell you about this guy here, Karl Woese. He's a professor at Urbana, and he had this idea. It was a hard-won battle that by looking at the DNA sequence, basically, of the pieces that lead to the ribosome, that we could finally have a phylogeny that was modern and advanced. Not to say that what was done before was stupid, it's just to say that this could really work well. And what blows me away is that in my own lifetime, in all of our lifetimes, a whole domain of life was discovered that's as different from us as we are from bacteria. You know, that tells you that we are pretty much at the beginning, okay? If you can go out in the world and discover a totally new domain of life. So there's this wonderful article. I'm showing it for no other reason than just so that you'll write it down and go read it. It's 6 pages. It's from PNAS, Prokaryotes, the Unseen Majority. What they tell you in here is that there's on the order of 10 to the 30th bacteria on Earth. They tell you how much carbon's associated with them, where you find them, and so on. And it's also fun to notice, you know, this comes back to the question of how do you measure things. There's an anomaly known as the great plate count anomaly. So if you go to a pond, like the ponds at Caltech, and you take a sample and you stick it on a microscope, you'll notice lots of different microbes. And if you try then to culture it, you can take LB medium, you can go to the grocery store and buy some, just use blood from a cow, you can use soup broth. You can culture a very, very small fraction, less than 1% or something, of these microbes. And so how do you study something that you can't cultivate in the lab? That's a really important question. And as I say here, even harder than to find out what's out there, it's especially hard to find out how these different organisms interact with each other and how they hurt each other. And this leads me, I'm just going to say one slide about this, mainly for your amusement. We've been working hard to try to find out in natural environments what viruses are there and who are their hosts. And I'm going to tell you real quickly what the idea of this is. So the idea is that we take 12,000 little 6 nanoliter chambers, we go and harvest the gut of a termite, and we dilute it onto these 12,000 chambers so that at most there's one bacterium in each chamber. And then what we do is we run a polymerase chain reaction where we're basically targeting the ribosomal marker on the bacteria, and we're also looking for a viral marker. So we have two markers that we amplify with fluorescence, and in a given chamber, if we get two colors, we know that there was both a virus and a bacterium, and then we go DNA sequence both of them. And the outcome of this is that we have two trees. There's a viral tree and a bacterial tree. And the question is, how do these things interdigitate? And for the moment, all I have is facts. I don't have any thoughts. I just have facts, okay? But you have to start with facts. And so we're starting to learn things about how these viruses and their hosts interact. Okay, that was kind of an aside. So the bottom line is this, that Boris mentioned this, and I think David did as well, and I think it's a very important point. People are going to a lot of hard work now to generate data in biology that's quantitative, like this. And my claim is that books like the Alberts book, which I think are absolutely wonderful, they talk about this kind of thing in words. And I think it's inappropriate to respond to this kind of data with words alone. And so the bottom line is that this kind of data puts new demands on theory. So I'm going to talk about this one at length, but let me just bring this one up for a moment. Because as I said before, I'm all about making prejudiced students. And I want to know, I want a student to know, or I want myself to know, am I surprised? Are you surprised by this graph? Okay, well, first let me tell you what it is. It's a plot of the level of gene expression in bacteria for a certain gene that's responsible for digesting the sugar lactose. So if you give a bacterium a choice between glucose and lactose, it will prefer glucose. But if you only give it lactose, it will make the enzymes so that it can use lactose. What they did in this experiment is they took two binding sites on the DNA and they changed the distance between them in one base pair, or 0.34 nanometer steps. That's what's shown on this axis. 55, 65, 75, 70, 85 base pairs. And then they measured how much the particular gene they were interested in was expressed. And you can see, so this quantity on this axis is, you should just think of it loosely as amount of gene expression or absence of gene expression. And the thing that I want you to, well, you maybe you could be surprised about or not, is the periodicity and where the peak is. So I'll tell you about the periodicity, but I won't tell you about the peak because I don't really understand it. The periodicity has to do with the fact that DNA is a double helix, and if I go five base pairs, in other words, if I take the distance between two sites and move by five base pairs, I spin 180 degrees out of registry. So that's what that periodicity is. But I will claim that the peak is surprising. It's 10.5-ish. So it's consistent. It makes sense. Okay. So what do I mean by being surprised and prejudiced? So on the left, forget about the details, but I'm just showing this as a reminder that Lord Kelvin calculated the age of the Earth and also the age of the Sun. And actually, it's a very fun thing to do for your students. I think you should all try this out, which is have them calculate the age of the Sun, assuming that it's burning sugar. It's a really fun calculation, and it's more or less what Kelvin did. He really annoyed Darwin. If you read Darwin's letters, you will see that probably Kelvin was the biggest thorn in his side. Both Kelvin and Darwin were doing good science. And yet, at the end of the day, Kelvin was the one who was wrong. He didn't know about radioactivity, okay? So maybe a more boring example, but I think one that illustrates the point even better is shown here. So I'm not going to go into the details, but this is the original data on the specific heat of crystals by Dulong and Petit. And basically, on this axis, all they're telling us is that if you measure the specific heat of crystalline solids, it's three times the gas constant R. That's it. Then another guy came along and did better measurements, and he noticed at low temperatures that the specific heat vanishes. And the beauty of this is that classical physics, the first thing we all learn in statistical mechanics is how to calculate 3R. And there's no way out. Once you've got the 3R, you're stuck. And so, as was said in the really excellent biography of Einstein, in order to recognize an anomaly, one needs a theory or a rule or at least a prejudice. And here, the prejudice is statistical mechanics. That can make you be surprised about this thing vanishing at low temperatures. And who is the one who figured it out? None other than Einstein. You know, quantum theory of solids. It's a big deal. And so, you know, as I say, I'm all about trying to find ways to be prejudiced in that kind of way. I want to come back to a theme that was brought up by Boris and also came up in some of the questions. And that has to do with proximity of different topics. So somebody asked about signaling, and Boris was talking about gradients and the idea that nearby cells, the difference in concentration could be relatively small. And a similar example is a bacterium can swim up a gradient when it knows there's chemoattractant, things that it likes to eat. And what I find amusing about this is in the Alberts book, the one that was mentioned by Luca, bacterial chemotaxis is on page 941, and Drosophila development is 400 pages later on page 1328. And yet, you could have those two topics on exactly the same page if you wanted to. because they're really about, somebody over there was asking about, you know, the physical limits of biological detection. It's really the same problem when viewed on that axis, even though it's perfectly legitimate to have them 400 pages apart as well. So I think this might be my last philosophical comment, and it has to do with what I think is an amazing fact and a wonderful thing about physics, which is that an equation like this, the diffusion equation, can get us so much mileage. It can tell us about carbon and steel, but it can also tell us about the configurations of paper clips and about genomes. And I always liked something that Feynman had to say in his Nobel lecture, which was, theories of the known which are described by different physical ideas may be equivalent in all their predictions and are hence scientifically indistinguishable. So, you know, think F equals ma versus principle of least action, or, you know, free body diagrams versus energy methods, or whatever. However, they are not psychologically identical when trying to move from that base into the unknown, for different views suggest different kinds of modifications which might be made, and hence are not equivalent in the hypotheses one generates from them in one's attempt to understand what is not yet understood. And so, you know, to come back to what Boris was telling us, I really think that this physical worldview, it's a different orthogonal way to generate hypotheses which are psychologically inequivalent. So I always like stories about human stupidity, and one of my favorites has to do with the fact that the atomic bomb yield was classified. This is kind of a classic story, probably most of you know it, but I still love it. I've actually gone and looked it up. On the cover of Life magazine, they showed these pictures, and what I especially love, because lots of times biologists do not do this, is they have scale bars and timestamps, okay? You know, that's a good thing. And so just by looking at radius as a function of time, that guy, G.I. Taylor, was able to estimate the yield of that explosion. And, you know, it's become a classic problem for people, physics types, to learn in grad school, you know, how to use fluid mechanics and make that kind of estimate. Now, what does this have to do with biology? Well, there are these classic pictures from electron microscopy. Here is a picture of a bacteriophage, a small virus. Notice the scale here, 200 nanometers. That white stuff is the genome of the virus. It's like 16 microns worth of DNA, 50 nanometer capsid. Here is a bacterium. Right in the middle is a basically exploded bacterium. The scale is 1 micron. That makes sense because bacteria are about a micron in size. And this exploded thing is the genome. And all I want to point out is that, and I recently taught a class at Caltech, and I just love when you say something, you just make drop a remark and say, so what the remark I drop is, if you take a bunch of paper clips, you make a chain, and then you jiggle it on a table, and you do it a bunch of times, and then you measure the size of the blob, and then you do it as a function of n, you'll get a square root. And I got, the next morning I got to work and I had a spreadsheet sitting in my inbox on my email. Some kid said, yeah, I tried it last night, I was bored, and here it is, and it was perfect. And so then I said, okay, well, you know, if you're really good, then tackle that problem, because it doesn't quite work. But it doesn't quite work for very good reason. And that's because the paper clips, there's a piece of tape in the middle on one of them, you know, so it's constrained. And so you jiggle in that case, and you'll get a different scaling, and well, it'll be sort of two random walks, and it all still works out nicely. Anyway, so that's fun. All right, so let me tell you a few concrete case studies. So I want to just give you one little story that has to do with how viruses package and then get their genomes back out again. And this is going to be a story about bacterial viruses, okay? And their lifestyles are a bit different than the viruses that infect us. So, for example, when we are infected by flu, the whole virus goes into our cells upon infection. In the case of the bacterial virus, the viral capsid stays outside and only the genome is translocated into the interior of the cell, as you see here, at a rate of between 100 and 10,000 base pairs per second. The bacterium knows what it's supposed to do with DNA. It's supposed to copy it, and it's supposed to make proteins, which it does faithfully. Too bad. Those proteins that it synthesizes, you know, in a process that's basically mind-blowing, that nobody understands, that's really, really interesting, they come together and make perfect little icosahedra, empty little icosahedral shells. And if you take these proteins in solution and you change the pH in the salt, you can get icosahedra, you can get cylinders, you can get planar hexagonal arrays, you can get dimers. You know, it's like a material science problem. But in the context of the very crowded environment of the cell, they will assemble into these little icosahedra. One of the vertices has a molecular motor. That motor grabs the DNA and reels it in at a rate of 100 base pairs per second, all the while consuming one ATP molecule per each one of those base pairs packed. The tail is put on, enzymes are released, about 100 of these guys go out and do their evil deed elsewhere. So that's the viral life cycle for the bacterium. So about 10 years ago, I basically arrived at Caltech from Brown. I'd been there, a professor there. I was working in material science, basically, as a theorist. And I knew I was very interested in biology, but I learned about this experiment from Carlos Bustamante's group, and I basically threw away my former life, really, just started over. Didn't write any papers for a few years or anything. So here it is. They take a virus. They attach it to a bead. This is about a 1 micron bead, and they hold on to that bead with a pipette. They take a second bead to which they've attached the, say, 10 micron long viral genome, and they grab this bead with laser light. Okay, so basically it's called an optical trap. The concept is that the bead is attracted to the focus, and so they can trap a bead, and then they'd go on a fishing expedition. They'd take the bead, go up to the other bead which has the viruses, pull away, and every now and then when they pulled away, they'd find resistance. They'd know they had engaged the genome, then they would put in ATP, and this thing would pack, and the bead would move, and they'd measure the rate. So this says rate in base pairs per second, 100 base pairs per second. This is fraction of genome packed, so this is about halfway, and basically they're watching as the genome gets packed. At the same time, they're monitoring the buildup of force as the viral genome is packed in, and you should just think of it as compressing a spring. Nothing more. It's maybe a nonlinear spring, but it's still a spring. And I guess, you know, it's interesting. You can think about, I think this is a very natural thing. This is a way more interesting thing to talk about for force times distance equals work than blocks on tables, in my opinion. So you do, the area under that curve is amount of energy consumed, basically. Or at least it's an estimate. And we can talk about that in a little bit more detail. So a lot is known about these viruses. If you go to the website called Viper, which is at Scripps, you can find the XYZ coordinates of every atom in one of these viruses. This is done using X-ray crystallography. These are five different viruses. This one's Phi-29, and that's the one that the experiment I just showed you was for. And this is a cutaway view, and what I want you to notice is the serrated structure inside. This is the viral genome. Okay, so the genome is packed very tightly, 50% volume fraction. And if you're not impressed by that, grab 100 golf balls and pour them in your bathtub. Okay, you'll have multiple layers, and that will be 73% volume fraction. This is one DNA molecule inside of a little ball. We're talking about, you know, as I said before, 10 microns in a 50 nanometer capsid. That means 500 meters worth of Golden Gate Bridge cable in the back of a FedEx truck. Okay, so that's the kind of dimensions. So there's a lot of energy that's expended to put the DNA inside of here, and the two key things to think about are the fact that DNA is stiff on the 50 nanometer scale. It's like an elastic rod, so it has to be bent, and it's very negatively charged. Every 0.17 nanometers, there's another charge. And so those two things together conspire to lead to this thing that I showed you before, which is this large integral under the curve. So a lot of work is done. Okay, so we got very interested in the forces driving the ejection of the DNA back out, and we were curious about whether or not we should think of these driving forces as being responsible for the viral infection process. So Paul Grayson, shown here, a physics grad student at Caltech, he basically learned how to do this experiment, which is a single molecule experiment where you take a glass cover slip, so you know this is like 1 inch by 3 inches, and viruses are non-specifically bound to the surface. We have a flow, you can see here the rate, and there's two molecules in this solution. One of them is a dimolecule that binds to the DNA when it's coming out of the capsid, and LAMB is a surface receptor from the bacterium that tricks the virus into thinking it is on a surface of a cell, and it opens its hatch door. So what you're gonna see here is an actual experiment in which we're watching individual viruses one at a time. So there's one, you're gonna see tons of them in a sec. Each one of those is one virus shooting out its DNA. you know, one at a time. And the goal here, I mean, you might say, so you know, what's physics about this? But this is freshman physics kinematics or whatever. We're trying to look at L versus T. And the reason we're looking at L versus T is we're interested in the relationship between the velocity and the driving force. We already know the driving force because we know, because of the Bustamante experiment and also our own theoretical musings, we know something about the force of packaging. And so one of the things that I'm very fixated on as I try to do things in the biological setting is I want to have knobs that we can dial as theorists and as experimentalists. So what are the knobs we tune? One of them is the viral genome length. So this is a 48 kilobase pair genome. That's a 37.5 kilobase pair mutant. So in other words, we're looking at a virus that's the same virus, but we've subtracted 1,200,000 base pairs. And you can see we can measure the rate at which the DNA comes out. This is time on this axis. The rate of these two is a little different. And then in this case, it's the same two viruses, but in the counterion is sodium rather than magnesium. So change of valency leads to faster ejection. Why? Because the driving force is larger. Why? Because the DNA's negative charges are not so well screened. So lately what we've been trying to do is the same sort of thing, but now actually looking at real cells and watching the DNA come in. And the way we do that is basically by filling this mini cell up with dye and then measuring the fluorescence inside as a function of time. Now, if you're really paying attention and thinking carefully, there's objections to this. I'll wait for the questions if anyone wants to ask. We've also been using a DNA tape measure, so we can label the viral genome at two points. And then when the DNA comes in, we have proteins inside of the cell that bind onto these sites. And so we can watch as they light up. And it's basically a tape measure for figuring out when different pieces got into the bacterium. Okay, so I'm going to move to my last case study, which has to do with how cells decide where to go. So this is a classic movie. And I would say it's one of the most classic movies in all of modern biology. It was taken by David Rogers, say 50 years ago roughly. This is a neutrophil. It's a cell of the immune system. These are red blood cells. There should be a scale bar on here. I apologize. This is of order, say, 8 microns. This is Staph aureus, a bacterium. It's really cool. So there's many, many research programs that have arisen out of that kind of movie. I'm going to tell you one little tiny vignette that comes out of this. And it really is just the question of how is it that cells decide where to go? So here you see a keratocyte. This is actually from the skin of a fish. You wound the fish. And what happens is these are the cells that actually migrate to the wound. And then this is from my friend Julie Terrio. And what this is the pathogenic bacterium Listeria. This is a eukaryotic cell. It's about 50 microns across. These guys are Listeria. And what they're doing basically is hijacking the host actin polymerization machinery in order to generate these little comet tails and cruise around. If you have any doubt about that, this is an electron microscopy image of a bead that's been coated with the relevant proteins that itself generates a little actin and drives around. So, you know, people are doing amazing stuff looking at how the shape of the thing matters and about whether or not you have it on long axis or parallel or short axis and so on. I'm not gonna bore you with the details, but the thing that I do want to say is that all of this is driven by these filaments called actins. So this is a very long, thin rod. It's made up of protein subunits. And the point is that in order to get motility, the actin needs to be put in the right place. So there's this classic model now, a cartoon model shown here. So this is the leading edge of a cell. This is a membrane here. And this really brings us right back to the themes that Boris was talking about, which is how is it that some external signal can tell the actin to form right near this part of the membrane and protrude? And the part of the story that I'm going to tell you about relates to two molecules, one of which is called NWASP and the other of which is called ARP23, but it really doesn't matter what they're called. The only idea is, how do you decide when to branch and put on a new piece of a filament? And the answer is that this NWASP ARP23 thing. ARP23, I should just call it the protein, binds here and leads to branches. But this protein, in order to bind here, has to get activated by a signal. And that's the thing that I'm going to tell you about that I think is quite fun. So it's shown schematically here, but I'm going to do it with my hands. It's very simply illustrated. I have a tethered ligand. Ligand, so some molecule. I have a tethered receptor. They're like this. And when they're like this, the thing is inactive. It cannot tell actin to be formed. Now we put in soluble competitor of this ligand, but without a tether. And at some concentration, this one will lose, the other one will win, and we have that configuration, and it's turned on. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's the basic story. So we got to thinking about the problem of tethering in general, because one of the most beautiful ideas in all of physics, in my opinion, is embodied in the Ising model, which is just this idea that you can get a lot out of two-state models. And in biology, tethers are one of the ways that systems can do something, which is a two-state behavior. Here's a little bit of zoology, a bunch of different protein examples. If you care, I'll tell you later. So to think about this issue of tethering, here's the simple idea. It's, as with many problems in thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, it's a competition. So here, if I'm in this configuration, then the entropy of the chain is reduced because it can't wiggle around as much when I'm in this configuration. If I open up, then there's more wiggling to be had. And then the same thing can be said for the ligands in solution. I'm not going to go through the details unless somebody wants, but the upshot is, as I turn up the concentration of ligand, external ligand, it becomes more and more favorable for one of them to leave solution and to bind the receptor and to appreciate the sort of Velcro interaction between the ligand and the receptor. So you can do simple calculations. Here I'm doing it just in one dimension. The reason I'm showing you this is just because it's a fun example of the binomial distribution, which again is, I don't blame most students for being bored. You know, it's pretty abstract and you have to get pretty nerdy to sit on your carpet at age 50 and flip coins all morning. And there's something wrong with that. I'm probably not going to touch on this other than to say that, so the last one was kind of a toy example, but you can use statistical mechanics and work out the relative proportion of this state, which is this one, this state, which is this one, and finally this state, which is the receptor occupied by one of the soluble ligands. It's all Boltzmann distribution shown over here, and then some basically binomial statistics in play. And what comes out of this is that the probability of these different states, that state, and that state, as a function of concentration is shown here. And what you see is that at large ligand concentrations, the dotted blue state wins. That's this one. So that means the active state wins, to come back to my previous example. How am I doing on time? I'm close to done, actually. Okay. So Michael Elowitz is going to come talk this afternoon. This is another example of coin flipping that I think is really interesting. And let me just quickly show you the movie again. So what's shown here, this too is very related to what Boris was telling you. So what we're seeing is bacterial cells in the process of dividing on the 1 hour time scale. And at the beginning, you notice they were red. The red was a particular protein whose job it is to shut a gene down for business. As the cells divide, the amount of red goes down. Okay, so at T equals zero, the red production was turned off. Now, when the red is lost because of the division, because every time the cell divides, each cell now has only half as much red, guys. As you dilute, it can't control the gene as well anymore, and now the green starts to get turned on, and green is a surrogate for, yes, I will digest the sugar of interest. And the idea that these guys had, I really love, and again, I'm telling you about it just because I think it's a fun case study. Usually, if you look at the kinds of images that Boris showed you or that I've just shown you, often the axes are labeled intensity, and then there's a horrible parenthesis, and then it says A dot U dot, close parenthesis. I hate that. That means arbitrary units, okay? And the reason is that people have a hard time knowing how to map between photon counts on their camera and number of molecules that were glowing. And the idea that Elowitz and company had was that by using the mistake made in partitioning, so if you take these eight guys and ask them all to flip coins, all the heads go to the left, all the tails go to the right, then you'll find that there's an error made. And that translates in this movie, if you watch carefully, you'll notice that the redness of the daughters is not equal. So it divided, and if you're careful, you can already see it. The redness is not the same in the daughters. So if you go and you make a plot, okay, I don't know, that's boring, but if you make a plot, you can use the binomial theorem to basically fit a line and notice 26 plus or minus 2 arbitrary units per LacI molecule. That I like. Okay? Because now I actually know how many molecules there are, and I can go in and I can really do the dissection of physics goes biology. Okay, I just wanted to say a couple of last words just for fun about the great debate between J.B.S. Haldane and Ernst Mayr, both colorful, larger-than-life, probably slightly obnoxious figures with strong opinions. And they had this, this guy was an amazing naturalist, super productive, and he criticized Haldane and others for what he referred to as beanbag genetics. And you should go look up this article. It's really fun to read. You know, he basically said all these guys, you know, they think about genes as being bags, and in the bags you have beans with red beans and green beans, and you reach in, and then sometimes you change the number of reds and greens, and they think they're going to learn something about biology that way. And so Haldane tells us his views of why, and they were friends, actually. So at any rate, it's just fun to see yet again another example where, you know, simple binomial distribution type stuff can be so potent and useful. So I guess I'll stop with some more blah blah. So I always love the part in Apollo 13. You probably have read Gene Kranz. If you read Gene Kranz's book, you'll see that the scene that I'm about to tell you about really happened, which is when they realized they were having a problem with the air and that they better do something. And then they realized that the engineers had designed different shapes for filters in the lunar module and the command module. And they poured everything out on the table and said, gang, I don't care if you're called physicist, biologist, engineer, mathematicians, whatever, go solve the problem. So, you know, he said, let's work the problem, people. And I think what's important is that, David mentioned it at the very beginning, you know, nature doesn't care about all of our names. I mean, our departments care, our budgets care, our students might care because we force them to do AP this and that. But the bottom line is that biology will be and already has been transformed by invoking Darwin's extra sense and using it to work the problem. Just a few criticisms of what I told you. So one is, I think I've told this before, but I think at this place, so I apologize to those of you that have heard me say it, but I still think it's important to say. There's a joke. What is a biophysicist? It's somebody who talks about biology to physicists, they talk to biologists about physics, and then they talk to other biophysicists about the weather. So, you know, superficiality is really a problem. You know, you can really go wrong by not even being wrong, to paraphrase Wolfgang Pauli, or, you know, throwing out the meat of the problem because you're using too simple of models or whatever. But there's a lot of things to think about there. It's also true that much of biological insight of recent years, for example, the discovery of the role of small RNAs, didn't require any physicist stuff. It was done perfectly well without any physics support except in the form of the technologies. And then I guess the last one is, in some sense, for me, the most insidious, although I feel the most courageous in the face of it, which is, you know, if you go to a faculty meeting in a biology division, they'll say, well, you know, is that going to lead to new biology? And if you, I feel confident that at this campus, I'll just venture the guess, in a physics department meeting, they wonder whether the biology types are going to generate any new physics. And, you know, another way of saying that is maybe all we're doing is dotting I's and crossing T's in well-understood areas. But I don't know any other way to go at this other than sort of along the lines of these people that did boring systematic experiments, you know, measure the specific heat of 50 different metals and then try and do it at a bunch of different temperatures. You never exactly know where the surprise is going to come from, but I'm pretty confident that if you don't look, you won't find it. So My scheme is I will keep going down the rabbit hole that amuses me the most, and hopefully many others will do the same, and that'll work. So with that, I think I'll stop. This guy, Dave Van Valen, is the guy who did all those virus experiments, and he's been a great guy to work with. Okay, thanks.
It sounds like you might have an opinion as to whether or not students in high school should learn physics first, biology first.
I do. And my opinion is that they should learn them both all the time from the time they're like six, the way that kids in Europe do. Honestly, that is my actual opinion. So they should be learning science all the time every year, and I don't even care if they call it physics or whatever. I don't know. That's a crisp answer, but I'm kind of scared by your question that I gave the impression that I have opinions. Yeah.
Okay. So I was curious. You had shown that you had a virus mutant that was quite a bit shorter, and you put a lot of energy, no pun intended, into showing how much work was done to pack it.
Yeah.
And have you actually shown that you get a lot less force out then on the ejection? And
yeah.
Then my biological question is, have you tried to do a fitness measurement to see if that impacts the virus's fitness?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about the specific genome to say if there'd be any other fitness interactions, but that would be a nice, good biological question that might silence some of your critics.
Yeah. First of all, as regards the force, we and others have made the measurements, the function of length, and the reason we thought of it in the first place was because, exactly like I said before, it's a tunable parameter, and I know in the theory how it changes the force. And we checked it doing a really, really fun experiment that was suggested by the group of Bill Gelbart. Maybe if you're interested, I'll tell you about it afterwards, but it's really quite interesting, using osmotic pressure to set up a force balance. The second question, we have not measured the fitness. There's a very interesting experiment from a group in Paris, François Tadi. And what they did is they actually have thought carefully about this issue of how tightly packaged the genome is and fitness. There too, I can show you the paper. I don't know if they've settled the question. It's definitely interesting. There's a guy in Texas named Ian Molyneux. He wrote a paper called No Syringes, Please. And he really thinks that this whole idea that the pressure is related to getting the viral genome across the cell membrane is nonsense. And so he would claim that there's nothing there in a way as far as biological relevance. Anyway, so I can, if you want to learn more about what others have done, I can show you this paper by Tadi, but I'd be delighted to talk about it more. The problem with doing experiments is, you know, every time a person like you asks a question like that, now what I've learned lately is that you turn the aircraft carrier. It takes 3 years, you know, from the time someone asks you a question till you do one piddly first experiment that isn't even right.
Well, I'm sort of wondering on virus invasion.
Sorry. On the virus invasion, you know, when you have that octahedral, model, are there protein coats, on the actual octahedron that could inhibit the virus? And is it a smooth, simple intrusion, or is it sort of a more complicated interaction?
Well, what I'd say, first of all, is that, let's see if I can go back here without creating a catastrophe. So, here, this looks good. So these icosahedral capsids, there's both the bacterium being infected and there's the virus. So as you can see here, the viral coat is very thin. It's of order, say, 20 angstroms or something like that, a couple nanometers thick. The dimension of the whole thing is like 50 nanometers. And, in some sense, the whole thing that you read about in the news with respect to H1N1 and all that, that's a story about surface proteins. And the battle between virus, surface proteins, and immune system and all that. In this setting, these proteins, the action actually takes place way down here on the tail, where it recognizes something on the surface of the bacterium. So if you remember back to our experiment, I told you that we do this trick where we have this molecule, LAMB. This is actually a maltose importer, and it's a surface protein in the bacteria. We steal it from the bacterium and we use it to trick the bacteria or the phage to open up and deliver its genome. But I don't know if I answered your question, but that's roughly speaking the story of how it works.
You started talking about DNA, and we always wonder about why DNA, or maybe earlier than that, RNA is the information molecule. When you look at force and packing and optimization of all that, does DNA look like a special molecule in those terms? Can you imagine other things that would work?
So I'm way out of my depth on this one, but I will say this, that RNA and DNA are super different as mechanical objects. So DNA is pretty stiff. And the way to say that is it's got this 15 nanometer scale over which it remembers the direction of its tangent. So, you know, if you start at the bottom of a palm tree and you go to the top and you point your finger in the direction of the tangent of the top, it's more or less the same as at the bottom. And that's true for DNA for about 15 nanometers. It's true for a much smaller scale on RNA. I don't know. Beyond that, I don't have anything at all to say about RNA, DNA, origin of life. I mean, I'd love to have something to say, but I don't. You might, but I don't. Yeah.
This will probably be a really easy question for you, but you know, whenever biologists on the molecular level talk about, well, we move two base pairs down and we rotate this and stuff. You talk, it's almost like you're talking about Legos, you know, like they're actually things you can touch. I'm just interested in the actual mechanics or the technique that you would use, even to do one of those things. It's completely beyond my, because it's so tiny, such tiny things.
Well, so let me start by inviting you to the little boot camps that I run at Caltech. September 9th through 15th will be this year, but even better than that, any of you that can afford it, New England Biolabs every summer has a 2-week long thing called Molecular Biology Boot Camp taught by Stephen Williams. It's an amazing thing. I mean, I know so many people. His former colleague at Princeton, Kurt Callan, who's the head of the physics department, a particle theorist, he told me it was the best course he'd taken as an adult, and I went and took it, and I was amazed at how fantastic it is. Let me just say it to you like this. High school kids with $10,000 can cut and paste DNA at will. It's a toy. It is exactly what you just said. It's Lego. You know, you just figure, so, you know, all the students in my lab, I mean, I'm not good at it, but they have, for example, a program Vector NTI, has every sequence you could care about. You just select where you want to cut. You can cut the genome in the way that you're imagining on the computer. You go do it with some enzymes. Then you can cut and paste by using what's called ligase. It's a particular enzyme that sews the DNA back together again. Then you put it in bacteria. It really, I'm telling you, it is super routine. It's something that, you know, if you guys had a little extra dough, every one of you could do in your high school classes and could and should and would. I mean, it's really routine. Yeah. Does that answer your question? Well, no, but so do you want me to like tell you the details of what you do?
You're talking about things that are on the atomic scale.
It's true.
Really, really tiny, okay? And it's as if you're saying, well, okay, I'm going to take this one here and
But that, I mean, you're not talking about you're talking about the wonder of science, not the science itself. I mean, I agree. I'm with you. I can't believe it. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, the bottom line is that here's how you do it. You call up New England Biolabs and you say, I would like to get some HindI3. It's a particular restriction enzyme. You stick it in solution with some DNA and it cuts it in an hour. Now you've got two chunks. You run it on a gel. You grab the piece you like. Then you take that and you take another thing called a plasmid and you put them in solution together and you add an enzyme called ligase and you wait. And in an hour they're stuck together and there's a circle. Then after that you shock E. coli cells with electricity while there's some plasmid around and you wait and then you grow them and now you've got the bacteria with your piece of DNA. I'm not kidding. Do you agree? I don't know. True enough. What's that? Yeah, so there, another thing is that many labs now do single molecule experiments where they grab on DNA. So I showed you this optical tweezer thing. So how's that work? There too, using, so this there's a trick called PCR. To me, this is like the, I don't know, maybe I should avoid too much superlative, but it's hard to avoid hyperbole when talking about PCR. So polymerase chain reaction. You amplify DNA, and you can do it nowadays. The chemistry is so good that you amplify DNA and you have something hanging off that you like. So you might have biotin hanging off of one end and streptavidin on another. You might have digoxygenin or anti-dig or whatever. And so now I can put the opposite thing on my bead. Again, I mix them together and wait, and now I've got a bead with hair. Okay, it's DNA with hair. And I go and I can take a second bead and incubate a second time, and now I've got two beads attached to one hair, and I can pull using this optical trap. And you know, I can show you some movies, people can tie knots. The thing that I like the most about it is that nowadays the traps themselves are calibrated by using DNA. We know the force of DNA so well. It's like saying that the scale is, if you have a scale in your house, you would calibrate it with bricks, 1 kilogram, 2 kilograms, so on. The way you calibrate a trap nowadays is just by pulling on DNA. We know the force response so well that you test your trap. You don't test DNA, you test your trap using DNA.
Yeah. I've read some of your book.
Thanks. I have two.
Yeah. I can't resist.
Too, I have to tell
I can't
you.
Resist recommended books, and it was a lot of fun. I have not done biology for a long time, but I was fascinated at what I consider a kind of physics approach to biology. Clearly, yeah. that's what you're doing. But yeah. Starting off with scale sizes, both spatial scales and temporal scales, starting off talking about models of various kinds, it makes a physicist feel right at home.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Well, thanks, but I mean, let's be critical though, which is that I think a legitimate worry. I really do worry about it every single day, but it doesn't change my behavior. Is that maybe we're just dotting I's and crossing T's? You know, it really could be that this is just bogus. You know, I don't know. You don't buy? Okay. No, I don't know. You know, the thing is that at least practically speaking, you might be a little worried in the sense that if you send your grant to NIH, that you can take some heat. I mean, so that's not science, but at least there you have to worry a bit. What?
That's good.
Yeah, maybe it's good, except when you're trying to run a lab. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, you know, it's good to get case studies. The more case studies we have where it's crystal clear that this is the way you learn something and that you couldn't have learned it otherwise are good. It's just that, like that wonderful graph I showed you, the periodicity, most biologists, I think I could say, they just don't care where the peak is. That's the thing, Boris. I mean, that's what worries me. You know, they don't care where the peak is, so they don't think it's an interesting question. And so, you know, it's like, maybe it's up to us to make our own taste. I guess that's the point.
You think you don't know what you're going to learn until after you...
Of course. I mean, that's... Yeah, I don't know what to say other than I just wish more people accepted that. I think it's good for me to get this microphone off fast.
Thank you.